From the Ronald Reagan Institute in Washington, D.C., this is Rendezvous with History, a podcast that captures the drama of presidential decision-making. Dr. Anthony Eames sits down with prominent scholars and leading citizens to bring to life what happens in the White House and how it shapes the world.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
And hello, I'm Anthony Eames, host of Rendezvous with History, and I'm so pleased to be joined here today with Peter Rohde, Assistant Professor of History at University of Utah, and the author of The Contest Over National Security, FDR, Conservatives, and the Struggle to Claim the Most Powerful Phrase in American Politics, just out with Harvard University Press. Welcome to the show, Peter.
Thanks, Anthony. Delighted to be here and looking forward to talking with you about the book.
Yeah, there we go. Hold up that book. I don't have the copy with me, but we have to make sure our viewers know what they're searching for on Amazon or looking for in the bookstore. So that's great to see. Well, Peter, we have a lot to cover, a lot of ground to cover with this book. But as we always do, we should start with the origins of the book. Why did you want to write this book?
Thanks, Anthony. Great question. You know, I think for me, growing up in Washington, D.C., surrounded by people who worked in national security, I always found it intriguing whenever someone would tell me, you know, I'd ask what they did and they said, oh, I work in national security. And, you know, even as a kid, this seemed somehow different or intriguing, right? We know sort of what a teacher does. We know what a doctor does. But what does it mean to work in national security? And so this is a question that lingered for me sort of through my childhood. And then after September 11th, I said, you know, it seems to me that people who work in national security must be the ones who now are going to deal with this problem. And I would like to be one of those people. And so I went to the government, began a career working in national security in the government. And it was very clear to me very quickly in the government that if you worked in national security, that came with power, with deference, and with seemingly unlimited resources. You go to Congress and you say, we need something for national security, and Congress generally would write you a check, right? People would go up to the Hill to ask for something else, not in the name of national security, and they get a big fight, right? And so it was clear to me that this phrase had some power. And so that was sort of the deep origin of the book.
Now, something you lay out in this book quite well is that national security hasn't always been around with us as a phrase, as a term, as a concept. This isn't exactly something that was circulating in the days of Jesus Christ. It's a fairly new invention. But before we get to FDR and conservatives and that battle to define what national security is, tell me a little bit about the kind of genealogy of the term as understood in the history of the United States.
Yeah, it's a great question, Anthony. And it's something that really surprised me. You know, when I started sort of peeling back the layers and trying to figure out, you know, where this term came from and how it became so powerful in American politics, I, of course, read, you know, a number of our colleagues, you know, articles and books who have sort of written about aspects of the history of the American national security state. And there are some wonderful, wonderful works on that. Andrew Preston, you know, Mel Leffler, among others, have done sort of Michael Hogan, great work on this topic. And so I sort of took what they said and I sort of treated those as hypotheses, right? And I went into the archive and I tested those hypotheses. And I kept going farther back in time because it seemed to me that the sort of concept of national security and its sort of special rhetorical power predated, for example, the National Security Act of 1947. That wasn't really the actual sort of origin story. So you go back earlier and earlier. Now, I mean, eventually I said, let's just search sort of the entire historical record as best we have it, going back to the founders, right? Who's talking about national security using that exact phrase, and what do they mean? And when I did that, you find sporadic references to national security throughout American history, but usually in a very vague, sort of undefined way, right? It wasn't until Franklin Roosevelt, really, I argue in this book, that you had a president seek to define national security and then to try and make claims on the basis of national security to build support for, in Roosevelt's case, first a domestic policy agenda, which was another big surprise to me, and then, of course, for a foreign policy agenda. So it doesn't go back to the days of Jesus Christ. And, you know, even though it appears sort of the language of security appears in the Federalist Papers, you know, you don't really have people seriously, deliberately invoking national security until Franklin Roosevelt.
It's interesting. We walk around today, anyone who follows policy debates in Washington, D.C. or elsewhere, when you think national security, you think foreign policy. Oftentimes, you think of places that are pretty far away from the United States. But as you point out, as you kind of sketch out in this book, national security begins with domestic policy as a concept, as an idea that's developed over time. So sketch that out for me. Sketch out Roosevelt's vision of a national security state all the complexity of it and all the kind of just enormity of the idea.
Yeah, I mean, it seemed very obvious to Franklin Roosevelt and his closest advisors, you know, in sort of 1932 during the presidential campaign and then in 1933 that the economic situation, the Great Depression, you know, the economic insecurity that was plaguing not just the United States, but most of the world, he saw that as the number one national security problem for the United States. And it wasn't even close, right? And he argued in his second fireside chat that all the steps that his administration had taken just in sort of their first few months in office to try and deal with the economic crisis were necessary for national security. He deliberately invoked that phrase in that second fireside chat. And then he tried to go about building what he saw as sort of a new and expanded government that would actually meet Americans' security needs. And at this point, it was primarily domestic economic security needs. And so the cornerstone, and this is the phrase Roosevelt uses, the cornerstone of the national security state in Roosevelt's mind was, and this is boggling to people like me who worked in a very different national security state, was the Social Security Administration, right? He felt like the pieces of the government that were going to provide economic security, that was the foundation of national security in his mind.
And so the focus is, as you say, Social Security Administration. But we kind of fast forward a few years ahead when there's been what intense debates about the viability of Social Security, the viability of that type of domestic-oriented conception of a national security state. And in comes World War II. 1939, Roosevelt sees both crisis and opportunity, it appears. Mm-hmm. So how does 1939 change Roosevelt's selling of the national security state and overall conception of national security?
So I think it's important to understand sort of Roosevelt's use of the language of national security as a solution to a political problem, right? The political problem that Roosevelt faced in 1932, 1933, and really in his first term was how to persuade Americans and their representatives in Congress to support his domestic agenda. Right, to build the national security state as he saw it, anchored around providing individual economic security. And so he repeatedly leaned on the language of security to do that. Well, if you fast forward to 1939, Roosevelt now sees the need to try and reorient American foreign policy to be more internationalist, less isolationist, right? More internationalist. And so once again, he decides to lean on the language of security to try to persuade Americans to reorient their foreign policy. The irony, though, is that in doing that, he helped to sort of nudge the domestic economic security piece a little bit out of the center of the national security frame. He didn't mean to do that, but that was one of the effects of his success in shifting American foreign policy through these invocations of national security.
What I like about your book is you do a very good job of tracking all the shifting language, all the shifting jargon, all the change in phraseology and political terminology in this period. And there's a lot. You talk about Roosevelt and his shift from progressives to liberals. You talk about positive and negative liberty. You talk about kind of the birth of modern conservatism. I want you to zero in on that kind of dualistic conception of liberty and rights, the negative mm-hmm. and the positive, and how that kind of inspired and informed the FDR side. But then let's jump over to the conservatives. How did that kind of shape the mind of conservative views of the national security state or what it should be?
Yeah. So Roosevelt had sort of a very clear conception of what liberty meant. And in his view, in modern times, liberty of the individual and liberty of the community, he believed those two things depended on positive government action. He believed that the government now needed to take steps to enable the liberty of the individual and the liberty of the community. Conservatives, of course, had a quite different view. You know, they felt that if you expanded the government's responsibilities, that would invariably infringe upon individual liberty. And so they framed government as a threat to individual liberty. And they saw Roosevelt's efforts to expand the government's, especially the government's domestic economic responsibilities. Conservatives saw that as a threat to individual liberty. And that really catalyzed their sort of perception that Roosevelt had found almost like a magic wand for government expansion by invoking national security. That really, I argue, catalyzed the modern American conservative movement and led them to really rally and try to persuade the American people that, in fact, if you do these things, if you expand the government's responsibilities, perhaps infinitely, that individual liberty would be imperiled. So you do have this sort of contest between liberals, the new liberals, Roosevelt being sort of the champion of the new liberals, and the old liberals, people like Herbert Hoover, who were now going to be rebranded as conservatives, this contest over what the real meaning of liberty was and what the government's relation to liberty would be in modern times.
So World War II seems to throw this all into a kind of confusing stir and pot. On the one hand, the battle lines seem pretty clear in the 1930s. More investment in government programs and state-run programs and state action and intervention. That is, you know, positive liberty, but that you don't want that if you're a conservative. Mm-hmm. You want less investment. But when we get to World mm-hmm. War II, now you have evil spreading over Europe. You have trouble in the Pacific. You need to invest in the state. To kind of fund this war machine. And how do you square the circle on that? From an intellectual and ideological kind of perspective, how do you bring those two seemingly disparate views into one cohesive, coherent perspective?
It presented a real challenge intellectually for conservatives in particular. World War II, you know, for people like J. Howard Pugh, you know, who was one of the sort of main funders and architects of the sort of nascent American conservative movement. And he was, you know, really sort of a libertarian in some ways, right? But he also received a lot of government contracts during World War II, right? And his business, like many other businesses, did very well during World War II. And, you know, my colleague and good friend Mark Wilson has a wonderful book about this, Destructive Creation, where he sort of talks about how business executives tried to have it both ways, right? They wanted to have the government contracts, but they also wanted to complain about the government contracts and complain about sort of government overreach and what have you. What ends up developing, I argue, in the book is this sort of selective anti-statism. It's no longer just completely against government and, you know, government should always be small. Now it's, well, government should be small in these areas, and those areas were usually sort of domestic economic security programs. But we're not going to worry so much if government becomes big in sort of military and, you know, foreign policy kind of areas. We're going to worry less about that. And this sort of selective anti-statism really begins to take hold in the country in the 1940s, and arguably actually sort of has retained its grip on the country until very, very recently, perhaps. You could argue there's been a recent sort of shift away from this, but certainly through the 2000s, you had the persistence of this selective anti-statism. And so I think that's how conservatives squared the circle. They said, we're still opposed to the domestic programs, right? But now we're going to be less opposed to the sort of more foreign policy focused programs.
Well, so we focused a lot on FDR so far. This is a Reagan Institute podcast. We do at some point in the conversation like to talk a little bit about Reagan. So let's go through the back door here and talk about Reagan's friends.
Yeah.
Or groups of people that Reagan was generally friendly to. I'll give you two and you can decide which one you want to start with.
Okay.
So the National Association for Manufacturers and Industry Group, kind of really pushing the frontier in the persuasion campaign, as you lay out, on conservatives and national security. That's one group you can talk about. The other, not a group, but a person, Hayek. And of course, Road to Serfdom. He has a lot to say on security as well. And it comes out in his book in 1944, which is one that, of course, Reagan read over and over again. So can you take those two, in whichever order you see fit, tell me a little bit about their role in this national security contest?
Absolutely. And I'd love to talk about Reagan, too. These are really interesting characters, sort of, who's a product of this whole argument that we have going on here. I think the National Association of Manufacturers is a really interesting case because they really did lead sort of the large scale public persuasion efforts in the 1930s against Roosevelt's domestic agenda. And when I say sort of it was a large campaign, it's hard to overemphasize exactly how enormous. I mean, as an American in the late 1930s, you could not go through your day without encountering National Association of Manufacturers sponsored, some people would call it advertising, some people would call it propaganda. Messaging is what I like to call it, right? It was messaging. You would hear it on the radio, you'd read it in your newspaper, you'd see it on billboards or advertising, you know, on the subway. You'd see it in, you know, newspapers at work. The NAM sponsored all sorts of speakers who traveled the country. At the beginning of movies, there'd be a little clip, you know, sponsored by NAM, you know, all pushing for sort of a certain vision of the government's responsibilities that de-emphasized domestic economic security and tried to persuade the public that the government was both incapable of providing domestic economic security and in many ways that the government was actually incompetent and that the private sector was more competent and therefore the public should trust the private sector to provide the economic security that quite understandably all Americans coming out of the Great Depression desperately wanted. So the NAM is very important. And of course, one of the key companies part of the NAM was General Electric, which in the 1950s began employing Ronald Reagan as one of its chief spokespersons. So Reagan really did receive, and he talked about this over the course of his career, he received a lot of his political education from GE executives and people who traveled around the country with him on his plant visits. And those folks were all alums of that 1930s persuasion campaign. So I think there's a pretty clear connection there. And a lot of the anecdotes that made Reagan famous, you know, his famous time for choosing speech, right? Funny little quips sort of that bash the government, but make people laugh about it, right? Or bash parts of the government, right? It's selective again. You know, those come out of this persuasion campaign that NAM sort of launched in the 1930s. So I think that's the NAM part of it. I'm happy to talk about Hayek too, if you like, or we can move on to something else.
Well, let's talk about Hayek, but I want to also spotlight one interesting one group in particular, women. NAM really seems to be women in the national security discourse, and to some extent, Hayek does too. Maybe not intentionally, but as you point out, Hayek gets picked up by Reader's Digest, which is probably the most popular magazine in the country at that time and widely read by women in the household. Tell me a little bit about Hayek and tell me a little bit specifically about women in this national security story.
Yeah. I think, you know, one of the really interesting insights that the sort of nascent conservative movement had in the 30s was that they should try not just to use direct persuasion techniques, but should also try and use indirect persuasion through what they called opinion molders in society. And so among these opinion molders, they counted teachers, religious leaders, and especially women. And so they really tried to get their materials and message to women's groups around the country. And you know, the people who are running this, the PR specialists running the conservative, you know, PR campaign, really saw women as one of the most potent forces in American politics. and tried to mobilize them as sort of in the conservative cause. Frankly, it's a great success. You know, if you think about the conservative movement's takeoff, you know, in sort of the 30s, 40s, 50s, then into the sort of course, the Goldwater campaign, women played a really important role in that, as Lisa McGurr and others, you know, have pointed out. So I think that was a very, very smart investment on the part of the conservative movement. One irony I talk about in the book is that the sort of the Rooseveltian sort of national security state, which included domestic economic security, in that state, women played leading roles. Frances Perkins, who was the Secretary of Labor in the Roosevelt administration, she was the country's preeminent national security professional in the 1930s, right? But by the time the National Security Act of 1947 passes, anybody who suggested that Social Security had anything to do with national security would have been laughed at. And women like Frances Perkins had been completely basically shut out of the national security state. And so there's an interesting gender story there. And it took decades, frankly, for women to sort of get back into senior decision-making positions within, you know, the national security state. You think of someone like Jean Kirkpatrick, of course. In the Reagan administration. You know, but it really wasn't until the 2000s that women in sort of more significant numbers were back in senior leadership positions in the national security state.
So now Hayek, that's who we want to hear about next.
Yeah. So Hayek, I think, is solved a lot of problems for the conservative movement. Conservatives had struggled to understand how to compete against Roosevelt, right? Because the promise of security was so compelling to Americans coming out of the Great Depression. And Hayek said, you can frame the pursuit of security as a threat to freedom, and you can do it persuasively. Now, of course, the version of Hayek that most Americans read, as you pointed out, Anthony, was the Reader's Digest condensation, which Hayek was furious about. I mean, he said, you know, most people are sort of representing, you know, what I've said, and it's, you know, they're sort of missing the subtleties, because Hayek himself wasn't completely opposed to some level of government provision of economic security. He thought there should be a floor, right? The government should provide a floor, nobody should fall beneath it. He felt like that was essential to prevent societies from turning to totalitarian solutions, as had Nazi Germany and so on and so forth. That part was, of course, edited out of the Reader's Digest condensation. But nevertheless, right, Hayek's central message that the reason Roosevelt had succeeded, he doesn't say this explicitly, but this is, you know, this is in effect what he said, was that he had sold people a vision of security, and that's what they wanted. We conservatives have to sell people a different vision, which is a vision of the preservation of individual liberty, and security needs to be seen as a potential menace to individual liberty. That was a message that conservatives were able to package in the 1940s very effectively, and especially in the late 40s, and sell to the American people. So Hayek, somewhat to his chagrin, but again, he became very, very influential for the conservative movement because conservatives were able to mobilize that part of his message.
Well, and this is where timing becomes really important. Hayek's ideas, as you point out, kind of splash onto the scene in 1944 and then get more prominent in 1945, right as FDR passes away, and along with him, seemingly, his comprehensive view of a national security state. Mm-hmm. And what you lay out is kind of a rump vision of a national security state taken up by Truman.
Yeah.
What was that transition in ideas and in implementation between FDR and Truman and national security?
It's really an important transition, Anthony, and it's really striking. You know, of course, FDR suffering from congestive heart failure, you know, he was not, of course, you know, the most energetic man in his final year or two. But nevertheless, in his 1944 State of the Union, he had laid out this vision for a second Bill of Rights, which was sort of the fullest, you know, articulation of his comprehensive vision of national security, physical security against attack, as well as economic security, moral security, social security, so on and so forth. Truman committed himself to trying to take up that agenda and then really struggled to do it because Truman, unlike Roosevelt and his speechwriters paid extraordinarily close attention to the words that they used in their speeches. It's really, I mean, it really is amazing. You look at the drafts, you know, thankfully the FDR Library has, you know, 7-8 drafts of all of his major speeches. You then go out to the Hoover Institution out in California, and you have Raymond Moley's papers, which are overlooked, but just they have all the handwritten notes, right, for Roosevelt's early speeches. You can see the care they devoted to choosing the language of security specifically to talk about domestic politics and domestic economic security. And then Truman comes in, and he had plenty of smart people working for him, you know, Clark Clifford, George Elzey. They did not pay nearly as close attention to the language they used to try to sell their agenda to Congress and to the public. And so Truman got in the habit very quickly of distinguishing between what he called the government's national security responsibilities, by which we basically mean, you know, foreign policy, military, things like that, and the government's welfare responsibilities, by which he meant domestic economic security programs. And that seeded the rhetorical and persuasive high ground that Roosevelt had tried so hard to stake out, you know, over the course of his presidency.
So we've talked FDR, we talked Truman, we've talked the Manufacturers Association, we've talked Hayek. There's some other people involved in this kind of competition for national security. Those are the academics like you and me, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Who are some of those historians, those political scientists, those academics who are themselves contributing ideas about what national security should and shouldn't be?
I think this is another interesting part of the story. You know, you have conservatives pushing back against Roosevelt's comprehensive vision of national security quite effectively, right? And perhaps they would have succeeded on their own in helping to narrow the definition of national security to what we think of today. But they received some help in this from both the foreign policy establishment, which of course exploded during World War II, but then also from a handful of these influential academics. And you know, the one that a lot of other scholars have focused on is Edward Meade Earle, who was at the Institute for Advanced Studies in Princeton, New Jersey, and who formed a little sort of study group basically in the early 1940s to look at sort of, you know, what national security should mean. It was sort of the first real academic inquiry into what national security should mean. And Earle, very early on in this sort of discussion, their seminar, he and his colleagues, which was a glittering cast of minds, decided that they should just say, you know what, domestic economic security is important, but it's something different. It's not national security, right? So they sort of decided to separate those things out. And this, of course, reinforced what conservatives were trying to do. And, you know, in the long run, I think, because some of these academics, Pendleton Herring from Harvard was the best example of this, helped to write the National Security Act of 1947, helped to write into law and policy this sort of bifurcation of the state into separate national security and welfare states. So, yes, academics, right, from time to time, they do play an important role in shaping policy and law.
From time to time. Okay. So we're at a point where, you know, national security in the 21st century is a phrase is I think you and I would both agree that you can hardly go a day without hearing it. And the question I have for you is the national security idea that we have with us today, is it a liberal Rooseveltian progressive idea, or is it a fundamentally conservative idea? Or some mixture of the two?
I think it's still far narrower than Roosevelt envisioned. You know, I think Roosevelt really did think that he could build a comprehensive national security state that would deal with domestic economic insecurity, which, you know, he acknowledged that World War II had ended the Great Depression, but he didn't think that it had solved forever the problems of modern industrial capitalism. Right. He said, you know, there in the future, there will be economic downturns and the government will be needed to stimulate the economy, you know, so on and so forth. And of course, we know that this is played out. Right. But I don't think anyone has really had a lot of success since Roosevelt in trying to invoke national security to justify domestic programs. You know, some presidents have tried, you know, but I don't think it's really been as effective as what Roosevelt tried to do. And part of the issue, I think, is that, you know, we've had now 70 plus years of a certain type of national security state, and it's quite large. You know, it's quite powerful, as I said at the beginning. And a lot of folks there, including me back when I worked there, don't have a lot of interest in sort of people saying, well, we should broaden the definition of national security. You know, the sort of true national security types say, no, like we need to stay very focused on sort of foreign threats and some domestic threats, you know, but it's all sort of in the physical security threat realm, right? That's the focus. So I would say we still have sort of a narrower conception of national security than what Roosevelt would have thought ideal. And the limitation that imposes is that it makes it harder for politicians to go to Congress and say, you know, this domestic problem really is a national security problem, and we need to treat it as such from a resource perspective and a national focus perspective.
Well, we've kind of reached that time where it's appropriate to ask you to give us kind of a hint for history, a hint for other historians or scholars working in this space. So the first question I always ask to wrap these episodes is, what's the archive? What's the research resource that really was valuable to you and could be mined for more, for more information, for more insights? So what's that for you?
Yeah, I think it's the Hoover. I mean, the Hoover Institution is just an incredible collection. And I think it's often overlooked by scholars. They focus on the presidential libraries, for example. But in the case of Roosevelt, you know, Raymond Moley broke, he was Roosevelt's closest advisor during the presidential, you know, nomination fight in 32, his closest advisor, arguably sort of 33, 34. And then he broke with Roosevelt and sort of shifted conservative. He decided to donate his papers not to the FDR library, but to the Hoover, right? And if you go to the Hoover, you'll see all these handwritten notes. I mean, it's just an absolute goldmine. So if you're interested in Roosevelt's presidential campaign in 32, you really need to go to the Hoover. But the Hoover also has an astonishingly wide range of collections, including the papers of Felix Gilbert, who was one of the seminar participants with Edward Meade Earle at Princeton. You know, I think I was the first person actually to look at his papers. They had literally just opened that collection. And so I'd say that's a really exciting place for historians. And I'd encourage more folks to go out there, and really friendly staff as well to work there.
Historian's treat to crack open a collection that hasn't been used since the author of said collection. And of course, if you're in California at the Hoover Library, you can just drive down south to the Reagan Library in Simi Valley, California. So what a good West Coast trip. Those two are often paired together. All right. So last, you've done some really good work here in the kind of history of national security, and especially in kind of the wartime era. There's always more to be done. If you're advising a graduate student to write a dissertation, what would you advise them to look at?
You know, I think sort of this, the evolution of the conservative movement, I think there's still a lot to be done there, especially as we're seeing, right? What it means to be conservative is changing, you know, right before our very eyes, and that there are some very intense fights going on right now, have been going on for 10 years now or more, you know, about what it means to be conservative, what it means to be a Republican in this day and age. And so I think that's a really fruitful topic for additional research. And specifically sort of this, you know, selective anti-statism, and how has that shifted, right? I think that's a really interesting thread to think about. And I'd love to see more work done on that topic, because I think that better characterizes a major sort of through line in American politics. It's not really just anti-statism. There are, of course, some people who are just, you know, anti-statist all the way through. But I think that's actually a smaller percentage than maybe we thought. I think more of it is selective. And so I think studying that selectivity, I think, would be a really fruitful line for future scholars.
And I'm sure, of course, if you write a book on that, we'll have you on the podcast. So there's a little incentive to go investigate that topic. Well, Peter, once again, thank you for joining me on the podcast. It's been a wonderful conversation, and look forward to seeing more from you in the future.
Thanks, Anthony. Thanks for having me. It was a treat.
Rendezvous with History is a podcast produced by the Ronald Reagan Institute's scholarly initiatives. You can learn more at ronaldreaganinstitute.org and follow along on social media at Reagan Institute.